supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, your brain on politics. I'm Larry Roebling. Yes, it has been nearly 2 years since candidates for president began campaigning, and we're still months away from the election. So, especially in this contentious election year, Dr. Dan was thinking about the psychological and emotional issues behind politics. What happens in our brains as we absorb all these viewpoints? How do we negotiate relationships with family and friends who hold different opinions? Joining Dr. Dan in this discussion are Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania and co-founder of FactCheck.org. Also, Lisa J. Cohen, professor of psychiatry, Mount Sinai Beth Israel, and author of the Handy Psychology Answer Book. And one more, the political science professor David Redlosk, director Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling, and author of The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. Today's special was taped with a live audience in WHYY Studio 2. We'll hear from our audience later in the show. But first, Dr. Dan wanted some context, so he asked David Redlosk to put this political cycle into historical perspective.
Well, it always seems worse than it's ever been every time. And in fact, virtually every election cycle we get that response. It's worse than it's ever been. It may or may not be, but it's certainly not new. We go back to the very first really contested American presidential election in 1800. Founders of our country, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, their supporters just went at each other, so that Jefferson's folks said about John Adams, he's a hermaphroditical character with neither the firmness of a man nor the softness of a woman. Well, Adams people responded that if Jefferson was elected, there would be blood in the streets and incest would be practiced openly. So it's really not particularly new.
Man, that's vicious. So we to put in context, this is not new. Kathleen, it looks like people are segregating more and more along political lines. I just read a survey where they asked parents how they would feel if their children married outside of their religion and they were relatively okay with that, outside of their race and they were relatively okay, less okay, but if they married outside of their political sphere, parents were less happy. I mean, that was the least acceptable out of all three. How did we get here?
Well, first, we ought to applaud the fact that the level of religious tolerance and acceptance has increased as we worry about the fact that the level of political tolerance has decreased. We're now in a world which is better because we're more tolerant of others based on differences in religion, but we're less tolerant based on political difference. And part of the problem occurs when we lose the ability to talk with those with whom we disagree politically because we're not able to hear those as philosophical differences. We translate everything into differences that are personal differences, identity differences. It makes it harder to govern.
You know, Lisa, one of the things you wrote, I believe, in your book was about group dynamic. Is this part of what's going on here, the way we isolate and segregate?
I think that's a really critical factor. Human beings have evolved to be social animals, and we've evolved to be group animals. We've evolved to affiliate in groups. And our group identities are a very important part of our psychology and our self-esteem. And we've also evolved for a certain amount of group chauvinism. And there was a wonderful study that was done in 1976 looking at 30 different East African tribes. So we're talking about a non-Western culture and variation within that non-Western culture. And they were asked to rate them, their own tribe and other tribes, on a variety of different traits. And 27 out of 30 rated their own tribe as superior to the other tribes. That means three didn't. I kind of feel sorry for those three because I think it's healthier to have some degree of in-group chauvinism. The problem is, and by the way, this kind of study has been repeated with children, with adolescents, with Americans. So it's really cross-cultural, this tendency. The problem is when a kind of natural level of group in-group chauvinism develops into group polarization, then it becomes really quite dangerous, and it can lead to tremendous in-group strife and even civil war. And the elements of that is that the other, the out-group, is seen as all bad. They're seen as completely different, and the in-group is seen as all good, all justified, and that there's an exaggeration of similarities within the in-group and of differences from the out-group. So I do think this is something that politicians can manipulate and do all the time and have done ever since there have been politicians.
Is that intentional?
I think some of it's instinctual and some of it's very intentional. If you look through history, it's very frequent, again, this is cross-cultural, that a leader who's having some sort of domestic trouble will pick a fight with an out-group or another country or with another ethnic group within their country. And that makes people, you know, rally round the chief, makes people trust their leader, and it supports in-group cohesion. So it's something that happens all the time, and sometimes I think it's kind of unconscious and instinctual, but I think other times it's a deliberate strategy.
It reminds me, and I think I'm right here, I remember reading the origin of the term scapegoat was in the Bible, where it was said, you shall imbue the head of the goat with all the sins of the people and banish that goat forever. And that's kind of what you just described with politicians do, and all the rest of us do. Kathleen, I want to go back to you. How and why do we get so stuck in our political ideology, other than the fact that we're positive we're right?
We know that as humans, we're more likely to be uncritical of things that we already believe, and more likely to take in information that's consistent with our beliefs, where we're far more critical about things that we disagree with. So that natural tendency sits underlying politics. And part of what it means is that as we hear disputes about what is actually knowable, it's actually factual, we're far more likely to be accepting of those things that are amenable to our attitudes and far more likely to reject those that aren't. And we tend, I think, as a result, to live to some extent, even before we come into like-minded media, in a world in which we've selectively reinforced our beliefs and selectively created distance with the opposing beliefs. Politicians come in and they exploit it. Then we watch like-minded media, we read like-minded media, and we tend to become insulated in a world in which we think we're more right than we are, we're less tolerant of other views than we ought to be, we're less accepting of the possibility of dialogue with those with whom we disagree because we just know they're wrong.
Well, let me address the clinician here in the House, and Lisa, that's you. When we're closed off like that, when we reject, when we're not open, my experience as a clinician is that happens when we close off our musculature, our psyche. It's about fear. It's about feeling threatened. It's, I don't want to know what you have to say. I don't want to get closer to you. I want to isolate myself from you because I feel threatened.
I think you're touching on an extremely important point, which is the role of emotion. And it's fear, but it's also desire. So it's both. It's risk and reward. And when emotions are involved, and the emotion for threat or risk would be fear, of course, anxiety, fear, and the emotion for desire or reward would be longing, desire, etc. When emotions are involved, our thought process changes. The more that our subcortical, older parts of the brain, like the amygdala for fear, or the nucleus accumbens for desire, the more that they are on fire, the more our frontal lobe shuts down. And the frontal lobe is the part of the brain, it's a newer part of the brain, and it does a lot of the thinking. And so what does that mean? That means we're making decisions that are very crude, very all or nothing, that our ability to see nuance, to see complexity, and to see other people's points of view as valid start becoming compromised. So I think it's very much about having a very emotional response to what's going on in the elections.
It's also the part of the brain that says, that might not be such a good idea.
Absolutely.
Because it impairs judgment also. So this is a Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and we're talking about your brain on politics, the psychological and emotional issues behind politics. I'm here in the studio today with David Redlaw. Lisa Cohen is here with me also in the studio. On the phone is Kathleen Hall Jamieson. Kathleen, I'm curious, would you believe, or is there any research on this, that politicians might intentionally not just manipulate emotions, but know that these emotions impair judgment?
I don't think that if they knew that and knew that they were doing it, they would ever tell us that. But I think we can infer from the patterns in which they communicate that they're aware of the differences. So historically, it is true that the most propositionally illegitimate, emotion-laden, factually impoverished discourse is disassociated in campaigns from the candidate, him or herself. It occurs in environments in which the source is not identified. In other words, they don't want it to be tied to them. That would suggest they know we're susceptible to it, but they're concerned that if we become aware that they're trafficking in it, we might hold them in less high regard, because perhaps leaders aren't supposed to do that explicitly.
Could you give us an example, if not from this campaign, just pick an example from any campaign?
If you take a look at the kinds of materials that are circulated historically in campaigns going way back, in the anonymous flyers, they used to be called midnight flyers. They would appear under your door or on your car windshield. That's where you had the racist statements. That's where you had the false analogies that were just blatantly offensive. The candidate was completely disassociated, but they came from somewhere. They were being systematically, organizationally distributed, so there clearly was a structure behind them. But the campaigns had deniability of them. If you look at the claims that are the most illegitimate that have occurred in the more recent era, they're more likely to be on radio than on television, and if they're on television, they're less likely to be directly associated with the candidate, him or herself, and more likely to be associated with third parties. So when we check factual inaccuracy, statements that are just blatantly untrue, and they tend to be statements that are highly categorical, they're less likely to be in the candidate's own words in ads in which you see the candidate's face actually speaking the words. And when candidates get into space in which they're held directly accountable, they're much less likely to do that. And so the statement that, for example, President Obama wants to abolish the welfare reform, he wants to gut the work requirement in welfare, is not one that Mitt Romney makes on a debate stage. It's something that's made in an ad voiced by a third-party announcer. The statement that Mitt Romney opposes all abortion, even in cases of rape and incest, in both cases those statements are false on each side, does not occur in something that President Obama states. It occurs in an ad voiced by an anonymous announcer. So that distancing tells us that they know we're susceptible to it, but they also know that we might think less well of them if they say it themselves.
Lisa, you've written a lot about narcissism and politics, and not just politics. You talked about it in celebrities, stars and athletes and politicians. So tell us about that. Give us a little education.
Well, there are two different types of narcissism. There is explicit narcissism and implicit narcissism, covert and overt narcissism. Overt narcissism is the grandiose type who is very extroverted, who has very idealized, aggrandized, exaggerated self-esteem, who feels entitled. They have a tremendous sense of entitlement. They also may, though not always, they may lack empathy. And this is the classic narcissistic personality disorder that's diagnosed in the DSM, which is the major manual for diagnoses, for psychiatric diagnoses in the United States. But there's also a kind of covert narcissism, which is people who look like the opposite. They look like they have very low self-esteem, but underlying it, they may have very grandiose expectations of themselves. So what has been shown in research...
Let me stop you right there. Give us an example of, people who have high expectations but seem to be shy and withdrawn.
So this you're not going to see in politicians as much. I certainly see it in my consulting room. People come in and they tell me consistently how terrible they are, what a failure they are, how they don't live up to certain expectations. And then when you really kind of get underneath the skin and find out what they're expecting of themselves, they expect to be in some very grandiose position. So if they aren't the top, completely famous star, then they feel like they're a complete failure. So I think that's important, but I don't think we see as much of that in politics. What we see more typically with politicians is the overt kind of narcissism, the grandiosity, the entitlement, and sometimes the lack of empathy. And what can happen is that being in the political limelight, getting all that attention, once they get into office where they have a tremendous amount of power, that can actually feed into their narcissism to the point where they really lose track of the natural limits of life and sometimes of the moral limits of life. And I think that's behind why there's so many political scandals and particularly a lot of sex scandals, because they get so entitled that they feel like they can get away with anything and they're entitled to anything. And in fact, politicians have even spoken about that. They've spoken about how being on the campaign and being the focus of so much attention has fed their narcissism to the point where they really sort of lost their grounding. The other thing to keep in mind is people who go into politics probably tend towards narcissism in the first place, because it's tremendously difficult and tremendously stressful, and you're putting yourself out to be attacked by everybody. So you need to have some pretty strong drive, and that drive can come from principle and a desire for public service, but it can also come from narcissism.
As you describe this overt narcissism and the potential lack of empathy, I think of a president in my lifetime who was the opposite. Jimmy Carter, you know, didn't seem to have a great deal of narcissism. He had a tremendous amount of empathy. And I guess if you look at it objectively, he wasn't a very effective president either. David, I wonder if you can comment on that.
His book, though, his campaign bio was actually called Why Not the Best? I think the fact is that if you are going to put yourself out in politics at every level, that response, it's worse than it's ever been. It may or may not be, but it's certainly not new. In the local level, you're going to go knock on hundreds, thousands of doors. You're going to talk to people face to face, and you're going to present yourself, right? The trick is, of course, for voters, weeding out those who have sort of a healthy sense of their ability and their selves and that empathy, and those who do not.
You're listening to a special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, speaking with David Redlosk, author of The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning, Lisa J. Cohen, author of the Handy Psychology Answer Book, and Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Coming up, do facts matter? And can we agree to disagree? I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. This is your brain on politics. I'm Larry Roebling. No doubt, after this election, there will be some Thanksgiving tables where the conversation will be limited to pass the gravy. Why is it so difficult for us to talk civilly about differing views? Dr. Dan asked Kathleen Hall Jamieson if we've lost the ability to disagree.
We know through experiments that we can increase the likelihood that people will be able to accurately represent the positions of people with whom they disagree, that we as humans can move ourselves into different selves. So we're not always our partisan polarized self, and some of us are less so than others to begin with. But when faced with a task in which one has to come up with the best possible answer, it's possible to move into an alternative state in which one examines the evidence carefully and does come to a conclusion consistent with the evidence. It's not easy to do, but we've been able to do it experimentally by, for example, giving people access to a full range of evidence and asking them questions about the evidence, letting them draw the conclusions from the evidence themselves, and moving them into a legal frame of mind rather than their polarized partisan frame of mind. I think to the extent that we can increase the likelihood that we work in school structures to have individuals be able to accurately represent alternative points of view, whether they agree with them or not, understand the points of agreement and disagreement across those points of view, and then articulate their own position in relationship to them, will increase the likelihood that at least those individuals will be able to constructively engage in political discussion without reverting to name-calling and visceral partisanship.
Well, I have to tell you, Kathleen, you and our audience, I'm about to throw David under the bus. While you were talking just now, he made this face like an arched eyebrow, something. Did I do a good job of throwing you under the bus, David?
I'd like to think I'm an optimist, but I'm probably less optimistic than I've been in a very long time. Kathleen's right. If you can do this, you can have an impact. But there's, in some sense, a basic processing that happens in evaluative context. The research I've done on motivated reasoning, the idea here is that we are often oriented in politics towards evaluation, and we are heavily motivated to maintain that evaluation even in the face of counter-information. So that one of the really robust findings is that liking a candidate, let's say, in my own work, learning something bad about that candidate results in actually liking that candidate more as kind of a defensive mechanism against that information. So it's just very difficult to overcome. It is clear in the motivated reasoning research that accuracy motivations can overcome this. And in some sense, that's part of what Kathleen's talking about. I'm just less certain about how you do it in the context of a political environment in which the goal is to evaluate and make a choice, right? It's not necessarily to be accurate in that sense. But on top of it, we are electing members of one party to Congress who actually go to Congress with no intention of governing, right? That has changed. You can dislike policy, you can argue it should be something different, but if your goal in coming in is to just shut it all down, I'm not sure, as long as people like that keep getting elected, where we go.
Kathleen, you're the co-founder of factcheck.org. I just have a hunch that you guys are pretty busy these days, huh?
Yes, we are.
So, you know, speaking of outright lies, does this cycle differ from all other election cycles?
Well, first, one of the reasons we don't use the word lie, except under extraordinary circumstances, is that we can't get inside the heads of the candidates to know what they actually believe. It's possible that they're just simply deluding themselves, and, you know, humans' capacity to do that is pretty high. It's possible that what appears to be deception is actually just simply ignorance. And so we would not use the word lie unless we had strong, clear evidence that the candidate knew that what the candidate was saying was inaccurate and was deliberately misleading the audience as a result. And you have instances historically in which we can say that. We can say the public was lied to about Vietnam, for example. I mean, we have documentation about what was known and what was said, and those two things were different. But in real time in campaign discourse, we think it's difficult to say that is a lie. We also think that it may be counterproductive to use that word too often. There's a reason that the House of Representatives, when it codified Jefferson's rules for decorum in the House, had as an automatic censuring process a taking down, which is the way of censuring, a person who accuses another person of being a liar. Because once you say that, you're basically closing off the ability to have future conversations. If I think that you're a liar, I can't trust anything that you say, and you're going to respond by distrusting me as well, and now we've lost the ability to have dialogue. That said, the level of lack of facticity this year is extraordinarily high.
Here's something I wonder about, you know, factcheck.org and facts in general. It's certainly important, but it doesn't seem to change anything. You know, I don't understand. when the information gets revealed that it's inaccurate, the press may or may not mention it, and then they move on. What can be done?
One of the problems is that the persons most likely to be exposed to misinformation are not the ones most likely to be in the news stream that has the corrective information. And so, for example, when in the Republican debate, Donald Trump alleged the association between the MMR vaccine and autism, a thoroughly discredited association, and the fact checkers quickly posted up the accurate information, which was that study was fraudulent, there was no association, that the MMR vaccine has many, many, many more rewards than risks associated with it. We were at best reaching 1.7 million people. That's my organization. Let's say the others reached comparable numbers and say we got around 5 million. The debate had 23 million viewers, and the odds are most of those viewers were not the viewers and readers of the fact-checking organizations. Also, the people most likely to believe that statement was correct would accept Trump as reinforcing it, and as a result might have discounted what we said even if we got the information to them, because they might have said, you're biased. You're in the tank for the medical companies, for the pharmaceutical industry, for the CDC. They would try to discredit the source instead of accept the information because they already deeply accept and believe.
Well, it seems hard to have an impact on that dialogue. I was having a discussion, well, to be honest, a heated discussion with someone several years ago, and I was citing some research, and he said to me, I wouldn't believe that even if it was true. So,
yep.
where do you go from there? I just gave the psychoanalytic, the media, Kathleen, TV, radio, and newspaper. I want them to be dispassionate, and that's where I want to go to hear about policies. I haven't heard about policy in the media, not one policy, ever.
Well, part of the problem is the news media's notion that they cover what is there rather than telling us what we need to know about what should be there. When a campaign is not engaging in a policy exchange, it's difficult if the reporter's mindset is to cover what is, whatever clash is there, for the reporter to get us back to what we actually need to know, which is what's the substantive disagreement across the candidates. The other thing that's happening this year is one doesn't know where Donald Trump is ideologically. And as a result, the cognitive shortcut that one could use in the past about a Republican or a conservative doesn't hold with him, because it's not clear that ideology is driving his conclusions on any policy stances. And so this is a year in which, even more than in the past, we need to understand what are the actual statements that he is making and the policy implications carried by them, and how would that translate into governance in ways that are different from our expectations of a Republican or a conservative, so those who are voting based on their expectations of Republican-conservative aren't misled when they vote for Donald Trump or against Donald Trump.
But to a certain extent, the same is true with Hillary Clinton. We're not hearing a lot about policy, albeit more than with Trump. We're not hearing a lot about the long-term implications of her policy. So, I want to indict the media here and not just make it about one candidate. Am I reasonable?
Yes, you are. And there have been serious policy speeches, actually one serious policy speech delivered by Donald Trump and another serious policy speech delivered by Hillary Clinton that were not covered as serious policy speeches. And so to the extent that the candidates put substance out there and the media doesn't know how to translate that into compelling narrative that we will pay attention to, the media is at fault. One of the places that we do increase the likelihood that the audience, regardless of its ideology, is able to see issue distinctions is in presidential debates. The question for this year's general election presidential debates is, will they provide that function, which historically they have? And that's an open question, because many of the exchanges in the primary debates, particularly on the Republican side this year, focused more on name-calling and exchanges that escalated the name-calling than they did on determining what the issue divides were between candidates.
Yeah, and that kind of behavior was often fostered, not that the candidates needed help, but was often fostered by the interviewers And the question.
The questions.
Yeah, it was a lot of gotcha politics. Listen, one of the questions I brought up earlier, you know, the show is called This Is Your Brain on Politics. How do we heal our brains who are on politics? And I think of two words I've used an awful lot this election cycle. Two simple words. One is, huh? And the other is, really?
I think it's important to try and take a larger perspective. I think that when we look close up and look at this election cycle, it can become very cataclysmic and very catastrophic. But we are in a country that survived almost 250 years of very divisive politics, and groups have a tendency towards homeostasis. I think the reason things are looking so extreme right now is because our country has undergone enormous change, economic change, social change, religious change, demographic change, technological change, which is fostering changes in the media, in all of the information industries. And we're seeing that kind of chaos and disruption in the electoral cycle. But I think trying to take a bigger picture and have some optimism that our country has been designed, our government has been designed for checks and balances, for homeostatic self-corrections. And there are a lot of people, there are 300 million people involved in this process. And there are a lot of people who are very invested in making things work. So I think part of getting the temperature down is to take a longer view of it. And then one other point, I think another critical point for everybody participating in the election is to try and talk to people, just as Kathleen said, talk to people who think differently. Because when emotions are up, there's such a tendency to demonize the out-group, to demonize people who disagree. And this is as true on the left as it is on the right.
Yeah.
And then it becomes very scary because everybody who disagrees with you is irrational, is crazy, is stupid, is out to destroy the country. And most people are really not that evil, you know, and they're not that irrational. So they may be emotional, but they're not necessarily out to destroy the country. So I would really advocate for everybody who cares anything about this election to try and talk to people that they disagree with. Do it calmly. And try and keep their emotional under control, and they might actually see things from a different perspective.
Well, you know, we know in order to have a real dialogue, the only way you're going to do it is first listen. First shut up and listen. So, you know, that's the way to bridge this gap. I heard you talk about the context and your optimism and you were right. I loved hearing what you say, the tremendous shifts in this country over the last couple of decades. And I have to tell you, you know, you spoke like a good clinician, that listening to you, my anxiety's down about 40-50%. And I'm going to cut back on my medication this election cycle because of your therapeutic skill.
That therapeutic moment was Dr. Dan speaking with Lisa J. Cohen from Mount Sinai Beth Israel. The topic this hour is Your Brain on Politics. How do we deal with the emotions that go along with a contentious election? Also joining the discussion are David Redlosk and Kathleen Hall Jamieson. Plus, what's it like to have this election cycle be your first time eligible to vote for president? We'll hear from a young voter ready to pull the lever for the first time. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to this Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. We've been talking about the political process, what happens in our brains, and how do we make decisions. Dr. Dan has been speaking with Kathleen Hall Jamieson, Lisa J. Cohen, and David Redlosk. Now it's time to hear from our studio audience. And did they have some questions?
This is to David. You mentioned the people who go to Washington with no intent to govern. How do we ever overcome that situation?
How do we overcome it? I guess by electing people who have some intent to govern, but that's a pretty glib answer.
Right.
I don't know right now. We are in a historical period, I think, where there's a lot of uncertainty about the direction of, you know, one of the great two parties. This is a two-party system. It becomes a real problem for the system if one of the parties is imploding in some form or another. Whether that will change, I think, is the key part of it. There are structural reasons for this, including the nature of the folks who vote in primaries, in Republican primaries, who are, you know, the most active, the most interested, and often the most conservative and the most anti-government. The Republican Party has been talking anti-government for many, many years, but especially since Reagan, and those chickens have come home to roost.
Kathleen, I want to turn this to you. Many years ago, I interviewed a congresswoman on the show who had just left office. And she said to me, by the time I get to Washington, the first day I'm there, I have to begin raising money for my reelection the first day.
One of the implications of that is that the system skews against those who don't get a voice. The media here have a high level of accountability. What is the money paying for? It's paying for television advertising largely. Why isn't it that major party candidates have open access to the airwaves at sufficient levels to increase the likelihood that they can accomplish their objective without having this fundraising dilemma facing them constantly? I think in the presence of the current Supreme Court ruling, we're not going to get rid of the money equation. The question is, can we create access in place of the money that makes the money less central to electoral outcome? And there's a real possibility that qualified people put off by this system, in which you are indentured and your time indentured to the money-raising process, just simply say, that's not the way I want to spend my life. I can perform my public good in some other way.
So let's turn back to our studio audience. Does anybody else have some thoughts, questions, frustrations?
This is Diana. There has been some discussion about the role, or at least, in my view, the lack of a responsible role of the media. I'm wondering how much an effect all these reality shows have on now our political system and how the media faces them. You know, these reality shows that are just nothing but outrageous behavior that almost makes it look acceptable. And a lot of the things I'm seeing in the campaign so far, to me, reminds me of a reality show.
Yeah, sadly.
Sadly.
Because it actually is reality. That's a really good point. And I want to turn to you on that, Lisa. And specifically, from what I read in your book, the people highest on the narcissism scale were the people who were involved in reality TV shows.
I did quote a study in the book that looked at the level of narcissism in a variety of different performers, and the reality TV performers did have the highest level of narcissism. I also did a study with one of my students where we looked at the correlation between reality TV show viewing and narcissistic traits just in the community, and there was a positive correlation. So it's all about kind of self-exposure and exhibitionism, and it also changes the standards of what's acceptable in the public. And once again, when you repeat behaviors in a group setting, it changes the norms. So what used to be considered unacceptable becomes acceptable when these behaviors are repeated. And then that can generalize into how behaviors are enacted in the campaign. So I do think the media and the changes in technology and the changes in the underlying economics of the media, which has driven the reality TV show movement, are clearly generalizing into our discourse in the campaign. I think that's a good observation.
I think that's a great answer. But I want to follow up on that. You talked about reality TV fomenting narcissism in the viewer. My God, how about things like Facebook? You know, it's all about I. You know, it's all about me. And look, I'm going to post a picture of what I'm eating for dinner. Who gives a damn what you're eating for dinner? You know, but it really kind of generates this sense of self-importance and I, me, and mine. And I wonder how that plays into the election cycle. Kathleen, I wonder if you can comment on that.
The early modeling literature about the influence of media said some things I think remain important today. The we, to the extent that we don't have direct experience with things, the media culture that surrounds us can create the models that create our expectations for how we behave. And some of those early effects were positive. So, for example, those who lived in all-white communities saw modeling of African-American actors in African-American sitcoms and dramas, and that helped accelerate the civil rights movement. The gay characters who emerged early in the television scene in scripts in which their behavior was integrated into communities that, that people who are not in that culture could identify with, I think helped accelerate the trajectory toward gay rights and establishing them as legal rights inside the country. But what happens when you get the reality show culture and the me culture of the social media, I think also has modeling effects that are potentially pernicious. One that I worry about is the coarsening of the culture, the extent to which name-calling, vilification of others becomes an acceptable norm. Impugning integrity becomes acceptable. And a culture in which activities which are illegal or highly problematic ethically are rewarded within plot structures. And what happens when across time that becomes more dominant in the media narrative, the popular culture narrative, than the other kinds of narratives that are more traditional community building narratives is something I think we ought to worry about.
Give us an example, Kathleen. You said illegal or at best highly problematic.
Well, when you have entire structures built around, for example, the narcotics trade and routine violence against others within a drug culture in which the heroes are actually the people who are engaging in the illegal activities. The people you are supposed to be identifying with are engaging in things such as murder. What happens when you've got your model of, for example, presidents of the United States and those in elected office in which you build in subplots as for example, the TV program called Scandal does, or as House of Cards does, where they routinely engage in ethically problematic or illegal behaviors? What ultimately does that do across time of your perception of those who are elected to lead?
It's funny. I watch House of Cards and I hate everybody, and I can't figure out why I still watch it. I hate them all. So do we have any other questions or comments from the audience?
My name is Anda, and I have trouble with the concept of anybody, absolutely anybody, being able to run for the office of president. Shouldn't there be some minimum requirement for historical knowledge, economic knowledge, foreign policy, some minimum requirement?
Boy, is that an interesting question.
The interesting thing about this is that the founders designed a system where the voters really weren't voting for president. Instead, each state would choose electors, wise and, of course, at the time, men, who would gather and determine which other wise man should be the president. Right, that broke down pretty much immediately as soon as George Washington was off the stage. But as a consequence, there really are no requirements other than an age requirement and a natural-born citizen residency requirement. It's hard to imagine how we would implement such a thing because it would certainly be highly contested as to what the standards ought to be. And I suppose at a certain level, you could say we will get presidents that are, in some sense, who we deserve. We like, actually, the idea of our presidents being kind of like us. We're always big on kind of pulling people down off that pedestal, right? So we want the president that we'll have a beer with rather than the one who knows something. Maybe we'll see something different this year. I don't know.
I'm thinking. Any other questions, comments?
My name's Annabelle. So I'm 21, so this will be the first election that I'll be able to vote in. And I see a lot with my peers the issue of not being able to talk to people that have different views than them, and I see them falling into that trap very frequently. What advice can you give to young voters so that they don't fall into this trap, or what trends do you see specifically with young voters in this current election?
Don't sit down, Annabelle, because I've got a follow-up question for you. Anybody want to take a crack at that?
I think that's a wonderful question, and young voters are a very important part of this electorate, and they have traditionally been fairly disenfranchised. Young voters tend to have very strong idealistic feelings. They don't get diluted by the pragmatism of having to hold a job and worry about whether you're going to get promoted or not. Sometimes they don't always see the fine print, but at the same time, they can be very passionate, and that can drive tremendous social change. Think of the Vietnam War and the counter-movement against the Vietnam War. It's an interesting thought. It's very hard to have a face-to-face conversation with someone who's angry at you. So if the temperature is too hot, you can always use what we've already been putting down as a bunch of middle-aged people. You can use social media, where you can actually make use of where you live and make use of this the medium that people use and make an attempt to say, let's listen to the other side. I'm interested in hearing why people support this candidate. I don't want to hear name-calling. I want to hear reasons. I want to hear why you feel so strongly about it. And then I want to hear from other people who support the other candidate. Why do they feel strongly about it? So I think, one, in your personal conversations, you make a real effort to kind of keep the emotional tone down and try to hear the other side and try to communicate your side in a measured and respectful way. And then if that doesn't work because the temperature is too high, use social media to promote trying to have a conversation and a dialogue instead of a diatribe where everybody screams at each other and no one listens.
Great answer. Now, here's why I didn't want you to sit down. This is your first election cycle. Just tell us what it's been like for you.
It's hectic and a little intense at times. You see everything on the media of, like, this is the worst it's ever been. And you see people like Donald Trump running for president, and you can lose hope a little bit, especially it being my first election. It's kind of like, well, geez, is this the way it's going to be for the rest of my life, you know, when I'm trying to vote? But I just try to educate myself with many different sources. And again, I try to use social media definitely to create an atmosphere where people feel like they can share their views with me who are my age. And, you know, you just try to navigate it the best you can.
Thank you.
I've taught at the University of Texas, University of Maryland, University of Pennsylvania, and I lecture across the country. The young generation has not given up on the political process. They are asking important questions, and importantly, they are identifying problems in need of solution. I think one of the ways we break this crazy polarized dialogue in which people talk past each other is to say, what do you see as the goals that we have as a country? What are we aspiring to? What are the problems we're confronting? And what are the available solutions? And don't define the dialogue in terms of left and right, Democrat and Republican, and polarized, already set in concrete terms. To the extent that on the nation's campuses you are seeing young people involved in asking, how is this economy going to provide the jobs for us that give us a viable way to raise a family and have a life consistent with our aspirations that will let us engage in our communities in constructive ways? What you're seeing, I think, is a focus that the candidates need to listen to very carefully. What these candidates need to tell, particularly the young, is how are we going to get an economy that is not doing as well as it ought to, that has just come out of a deep recession, into a better place, an economy that whose last job report is not encouraging. What are the specific things that they are able to do as president, and how are they going to work with the Congress in order to try to get us there? I think what we also see because of an increasing level of engagement at the high school level is students who have been intensely involved in their local community, and as a result, who see problems and solutions at the local level in different terms and see their ability to act as individuals as a way of creating individual solutions, even if the larger national problems seem more intractable. And that form of civic engagement is part of what gives me hope that we're going to get through this difficult period.
And I just want to conclude with this thought for anybody who wants to make change. Anybody can become a leader in their community and let it stretch out beyond that. Anybody, because that's how change has happened over the decade.
One way to deal with what we've been calling a contentious election cycle is to go back in time and listen to Will Rogers. And humor will always help us through this.
Now they got another plan. They figured out that what's the matter with this country is, I bet you couldn't guess it in a million years. They couldn't guess this plan. They figured out what's the matter with the country and going to spend $500 million on it. Well, you know what it is? Well, it's the people try to cross a railroad track without looking both ways. That's what it is. This is going to fix the grade crossing. That's what that is. Well, you say, the problem is to teach the people to look both ways. Drive up the track and look up and down, then cross. Well, that's exactly what's the matter with us, even when it don't apply to railroad trains. Everybody looked one way in 1928 and 29, around there. That's when the train hit all of us, you know.
This has been a Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb and his guests, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and co-founder of FactCheck.org. David Redlosk, professor of political science and author of The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning, and Lisa J. Cohen, professor of psychiatry, Mount Sinai Beth Israel, and the author of The Handy Psychology Answer Book. If you'd like to be part of our live audience at our next taping, keep an eye on the WHYY events page for more information. And talk to us. We're on Twitter at Voices in the Fam. We'd love to hear from you. The engineer for today's show was Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of WHYY audio content. Mike and Scott is Voices executive producer. I'm Larry Roebling, producer of Voices in the Family.
Have a good week, my friends. And the week after that, and the week after that, and the week after that.